You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show, where's the Republican Party headed with Trump leading the charge? My guests Tim Marshall and John Everard will be looking at how to bridge the divisions in the GOP, as well as the day's other top stories, including...
Unfortunately, the West is supporting terrorism and taking sides with coups.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accuses the West of colluding with terrorists. We'll ask if there's anyone left to blame for Turkey's failed coup. And...
we want to stop them before they start to attack us. But of course, if they should get through, and we can't guarantee they will never get through, we've got to be ready.
We'll be asking if the UK's anti-terror police are up to the job of preventing a major attack on British soil. All that, plus why South Korea's got beef with corruption. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News, and John Everard, former British diplomat and ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. We begin today in the United States, and the continuing plight, is perhaps one word for it, of the Republican Party, saddled with Donald Trump as its nominee for this year's presidential elections. The party's in disarray with the ongoing reluctance of its top names to endorse Trump as the candidate. In the past 24 hours, having been turned on its head, Trump's refusing to endorse some of the GOP's major players, such as Paul Ryan and John McCain, in their bids for re-election in their respective states of Wisconsin and Arizona. John, how long can this kind of behaviour in the GOP go on? Presumably right up until, you know, election day in November.
And beyond. I mean, why should it stop there? They're clearly thoroughly enjoying themselves. You know, who's going to spoil a good party? Yes, you're right. This is a party that is undergoing multiple fractures. Not just is there an intense disagreement over policy between, you might call them, the conservative, the traditional Republicans on the one side and Trump and his people on the other. That's quite clear. But I think it's more than that. I think, Trump is a classic demagogue. And in a sense, the Republican Party struck unlucky that he grew out of their ranks. Demagogues can come from almost anywhere on the political spectrum. And it's when you've got a demagogue coming out as your candidate, it's not just a difference of policy, though that too, it's a difference of style. And I think that what has really riled senior Republicans is not what Trump says, it's the way he says it, the way he seems almost incapable of uttering even the most banal political statement without insulting somebody. And you can sense the exasperation building. I mean, I think a lot of senior and otherwise very patient people have simply had enough. Where does it go from here? It's going to take a long time for the grand old party to recover its unity. It's been very, very badly damaged. And at the same time, remember Nate Silver, the man who predicted the 2012 election? Of course, what attracted attention at the time was the fact he was so successful in his predictions. What attracted less attention was that if you run the methodology, the calculations he used to get to where he got to, you can see that the Republican Party is going to find the hill steeper and steeper and steeper to climb as the demography of America changes. So even without these bitter internal disputes, the Republican Party is in deep trouble. It may actually be in terminal decline.
I guess that's the thing to pick up on there, Tim. Is it a terminal decline, or is it just a decline? Is it a correctable dip in the roller coaster?
It's a terminal decline as long as people like Mr. Trump only appeal to a certain section, which is overwhelmingly white, predominantly male, and you're right. You're never going to win another election in the United States with just that demographic, and so. You do have to reach out. If you look at the demographics of places like Arizona, California, and Texas, you know, you're not going to win those with that sort of demographic support. So he is an aberration. You cannot rule out him winning. He doesn't care that the Republican elite don't like him. He will make hay out of it. And we will find out if he can do it without the party itself coming in behind him and backing him, I think he can probably run a campaign without them, and he'll pick up a few extra votes precisely for doing that. Can he go all the way? We've written him off so many times. I'm just thinking this time, with what has happened this week and with the row within the party itself, that it's possible he may have peaked.
We'll talk a bit more about the idea of running a campaign without that party machine behind you in just a second. But, John, I want to pick up on that point. I mean, Tim says there it's an aberration. But interestingly, I think you and I even have had that conversation in this studio, going right back over the last political cycle, about how the Republicans needed to find somebody who could galvanise a vote, you know, maybe get amongst the Latino community or the African-American community, be more appealing to female voters. This issue of needing to appeal to demographic, you know, Trump's not a one-off. He's maybe an aberration in the sense that he's worse than anyone could have imagined. But the Republican Party's had plenty of warning, and it does seem that the party mechanics have failed because they have been unwilling or unable to address this, which has been a pressing issue for certainly an entire political generation already.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a great deal of soul-searching going on within the Republican Party right now about just that failure. How on earth did we get Trump? I mean, you may remember, I don't think it was actually in his renunciation speech, but very shortly after, Kasich produced quite a good analysis of what was wrong with the internal systems of the Republican Party, which was never challenged. I mean, I get the sense that, okay, it was Kasich who came out and said it, but most people agree with it. Mm. There's a great deal there that needs fixing. Coming back to Tim's point, you know, the basic one, is Trump going to win? I think this election is, I mean, all elections are unpredictable, all polls are unreliable, of course, but this one is particularly difficult to call because, as I said before, this man is a demagogue, and we have no real sense of how wide his actual support on the day is going to stretch.
And what happens in the next 98 days as well, terrorist attacks or whatever, which do have an effect. He says, yeah, I mean, I've said I think he's peaked, but, you know, here we are, the three of us seemingly agreeing, and, you know, when you listen to a European or, in fact, a non-American audience, everybody seems to agree that the guy's nuts or whatever, even though he's not. But, you know, in the United States of America, you get poll after poll after poll, and he's polling pretty near 50%. So they are listening to him, and I've said this on this program before, they're listening to him with an American ear. We listen to him with an outsider's ear, and we don't hear it quite as clearly as the Americans do. Again, how big is the Tea Party? How big is the anger? How much is the backlash against business as usual? And how much demagoguery? And we look around the world, and it is growing everywhere, and the United States goes through these periods periodically. It's going through one now, and you cannot write him off because everyone wrote him off every month for the past 12 months.
I wonder, though, as you said earlier, Tim, there might be a bit of a check. I wanted to listen to a short clip, actually, that maybe speaks to the kind of leader that a President Trump might be. On the popular US show Morning Joe, which is MSNBC's Joe Scarborough, he was citing an unnamed source who'd been party to a rather terrifying exchange between Trump and a nameless security advisor. Let's take a short listen to this.
Several months ago, a foreign policy expert on the international level went to advise Donald Trump, and three times he asked about the use of nuclear weapons. Three times he asked, at one point, if we have them, why can't we use them? That's one of the reasons why he just doesn't have foreign policy experts around.
Trump asked three times.
Three times in an hour briefing, why can't we use nuclear weapons?
Joe Scarborough talking on MSNBC's Morning Joe today. Now, John, you know, even to those people who say, hey, you know, this guy's a straight shooter, he says it how it is, there's a certain disconnect from what the last 50 years of history globally tell us about the world and geopolitics implicit in that story. If true, of course, we don't know. Surely that kind of thing is enough to scare even people who were inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt as a kind of an ordinary guy you could have a beer with. Or is that just me hoping?
That's just you hoping.
Yep.
The kind of people who are going to vote for Trump, if anything, I fear, and this sends my blood as cold as I'm sure it sends yours, will approve of somebody who talks tough and makes clear
that he's... This isn't talking tough, is it? I mean, that's someone who's divorced from reality, no? I mean...
Yes, you see a problem with that? I mean, sorry, that was a flip remark. But yes, of course he's divorced from reality, but I'm not sure that that is actually going to worry the kind of people who are going to vote for him. These people are looking for a messiah, and they think they may have found one.
Picking up on that, also, why is Morning Joe sat on that for 3 months? It was on MSNBC, which is the uber-liberal TV 24-hour station of the United States. And I watched it this morning, and there were jaws dropping at this story, and it is deeply scary. But I would go back to this thing about us listening with a European ear. He is a brash American businessman that does business in a New York kind of way, and he's quite happy to challenge people and say, well, why can't I use a nuke? You know, or why can't I buy this company? For him, it's all just a negotiation. So you've got to hope, and it is only hope, that behind that brash exterior, he doesn't really think, why the hell? Because he understands that it kills tens of millions of people and sparks a global war and a nuclear winter. You've got to hope. But we don't know that. But I do go back to this idea about this ear that we listen with. The other example this week is when he said about the baby. Now, your listeners probably heard it. You know, there's a baby crying. He says, oh, I love babies. Don't worry, it's fine. And then he says, now, you know what? Get the baby out. I said this last time, the guy's missed his calling in the world. He should have been a stand-up comedian. And again, there'll be people listening to that and think they'll be guffawing with laughter at his timing. We're all absolutely just outraged that he should tell the woman to take the baby out of the hall.
Now, if we could just come back to what the GOP does about this problem. And obviously, we already identified that it could be a sort of a generational, maybe, adjustment that's needed in political terms. John, to pick up on that point you made about these fissures, this fragmentation being so pronounced that it could be the kind of the end of the line. You know, we know the US is so wedded to this two-party system beyond maybe any other country, certainly any other liberal democracy potentially. What could that look like? Are we talking about a breakup of the GOP potentially?
I suppose that's possible, yes. I mean, if you had a breakup of the GOP, do you then end up with a three-party system in the United States? It's an intriguing thought, isn't it? I think it's more likely that, well, you know, if Trump wins this election, he is going to be in a very strong position to stamp his mark on the Republican Party. He may actually succeed in changing the Republican Party to something in his image, which is kind of scary, but it's a possibility. If he loses, then I suspect that he will just crash and burn. He will fade out. And bit by bit, the elders of the Republican Party will pit themselves up, dust themselves down, and try to restore the Republican Party to what it was pre-Trump. I think those are the two most likely outcomes.
But, and is it the elders, Tim, that we need here? Or does the Republican Party, the Republican movement, does it need to go through a new Labour moment,
well,
almost?
I was just going to come to the British example. It's funny because we're talking about people like Paul Ryan, who, again, the European liberal elite used to sort of, you know, wave a crucifix over and say, get back, because he was so right-wing. And then they realised there's people even more right-wing or nuts or whatever. But I completely agree with what was just said. If he wins, he's going to change the party. I suspect the party would then split. And it is similar, very, very vaguely, to the United Kingdom, where you've got the Parliamentary Labour Party, the MPs on the left, who do not support their own leader. And the longer it goes on in this country, the more likely there will be that the Labour Party will split in two and there'll be a centre Social Democratic Party. And this, again, is a phenomenon in Spain, in Italy, in Britain, elsewhere, the splintering of the two-party system. So there's no reason why the Americans necessarily should be immune from that. And there's an awful lot of people like Warren Buffett, natural Republican supporters, but also liberal, who could not stay within a party led by him. And there are quite a lot of people. I think it was the chief executive, Hewlett-Packard, has also said she's a dye-in-the-wool Republican, but she's came out and said she's going to be voting for Mrs. Clinton.
I just wonder, maybe finally on this point, and John, I think, again, we've picked up on this before, that a bit of a crisis in the political class, and maybe a crisis of personalities. Is one of the problems here that there has not been a standout politician, somebody who could, say, do, to go back to that example, like what Tony Blair did during the mid-1990s in this country, and kind of change things around, challenge some preconceptions about what a political party represents. And could there be a hope that rather than the old guard you mentioned before, there could be I mean, it's hard to imagine it in the, with the GOP in the state it's in, but a unity candidate, perhaps, maybe someone who is himself or herself Latino or African-American, who could maybe bring some cohesion back to the Republican movement.
I'd love to be able to agree with you, but I have to say, I just don't see anybody right now. I mean, it may be that somebody will emerge from a Republican movement somewhere, outside the normal focuses of attention. But there's nobody standing in front of cameras at the moment who conforms in any way to the kind of profile you've just described.
Could it be there's someone who's so smart they realise it's just toxic at the moment, so they'll keep a low profile?
Yes.
It's
possible. But again, this is part of the agonising of the Republican Party. Trump got to where he is essentially because the traditional Republicans couldn't put anybody up with the charisma, with the kind of leadership capability, with the vision of how the Republican Party could be, who was going to challenge Trump effectively. And Trump crushed all his rivals. It's gone down really badly on the Hill.
Let's move on. Now, you might think there's nobody left to suspend, investigate or arrest in Turkey, but President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's purge continues. The latest to be targeted by authorities for contributing to last month's failed coup include members of Turkey's football authorities. 94 officials have been fired, including referees. And the offices of the National Science Research Council have been raided. But Western governments aren't escaping the flak. Yesterday, Erdogan blamed the West for the spread of terrorism in Turkey, perhaps predictably. Tim, does Erdogan have anyone else left to blame that he hasn't got round to yet?
There's probably a few people left that you could still point the finger at. He's cleaning up. It's absolute clean-up time. This is not just about the Gulen movement. This is about anybody that might stand in his way. He's on his way to transferring power from the prime ministership to the presidency. I mean, he's taken that power with him by sheer force of personality, but under the Turkish constitution, the prime minister remains theoretically more important. He will use this to smash all opponents out of the way, change the constitution, transfer the power to the presidency, and he will be president probably for a very long time. Now, the problem with criticizing him to his supporters is that they immediately say, hang on a minute, there was a military coup. And actually, they've got a very, very strong point. There was a military coup attempt. Their parliament was bombed. They do have the absolute right to go after the people that put it together and to go after many of their supporters. I would argue it's a different thing to then suspend 70,000 people, including football referees. I mean, this is a complete clearing of the stables. Last thing, they also have a point when they point out that nobody from Europe has gone over there to say solidarity with you, your democracy, standing up again. No one. Well, today, actually, the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, whose name escapes me. You know, where is Federica Mogherini from the EU? Where are the prime ministers? Why haven't they stood in solidarity? I think it's because they realise how far he's going in the anti-democratic direction.
And I guess it's harder to comment the longer this purge continues. But interestingly, they were, unified in their silence over the coup at the time. Very few people came out, whether it's other secretaries of state, our own foreign minister. Nobody came out and said, unequivocally, we disagree with this, which is rather interesting. John, let me ask you, in recent memory at least, the numbers that Tim mentioned there, 70,000 people suspended from work, 18,000 detained, whether it's media, publishing, education, the military, the judiciary. I mean, this is, if not unprecedented, there aren't many recent examples of a purge or whatever you want to call it on this scale.
You'd have to go back to the early days of the Cultural Revolution in China, or before that, to Joe Stalin on a bad day. Yes, this is not quite unprecedented, I don't think, but it is very rare.
Extraordinary, yeah.
And it is extremely damaging. And yes, of course, Tim is quite right to remind us that there was an attempted military coup. But of course, this goes way beyond any proportionate response to that coup. Does anybody seriously believe that football referees were involved in plotting against the president? This starts to become almost comical. We could laugh if it wasn't so serious. And Erdogan appears at the moment to be lashing out against everything, not just, as Tim pointed out, internal enemies, well, and he sees a lot of people as enemies, but against the world in general, criticising the United States, criticising Europe, demanding Gulen's surrender, even though, of course, there's been nothing approaching a judicial process, an extradition process, which would have to be backed with evidence. There doesn't seem to be actually much evidence at all that Gulen was involved in this coup. Remember, he was very quick to come out and condemn it. He was condemning it before it was clear that it had failed, which seems unlikely, you know, if
you
had
mastermind,
yes.
And what about, you mentioned that this idea of Erdogan lashing out at other supranational organisations and so on. What about the European Union? Because he's issued something of a broadside at, well, essentially the whole bloc, potentially with some justification, one could argue. And he's also talked about this failure on respecting the refugee deal that was struck. It does seem to be a very direct challenge to some of the demands that the EU as a bloc have issued to Ankara in terms of one day looking at Turkish accession. That's off the table. Are we talking generations
off the table
now?
Off the table. Yeah. I mean, your grandchildren might just see it. But not only is the relationship between Turkey and the EU much, much more strained than it has been for a very long time, but you don't get the sense that there's any great appetite in Turkey itself now for accession. People are changing their mind.
Yeah, and that's funny because anecdotally, people on the streets, we talked to our bureau chief there, and there was still an enthusiasm for the European project, even as the refugee crisis began to reach, true crisis point.
Well, was that in Istanbul, and was he talking to people who speak English?
I mean, I see that you're making a reasonable point, Tim.
Yeah, because I've said this before. You go to Tehran, you get off the plane, you go up to North Tehran, you go to the university, you find a woman who's got a headscarf pushed halfway back over her head, you interview her, she speaks in English about Western values, and you say, there's the youth of Iran, which is complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. If you move a few feet outside of Istanbul, you'll see Turkey. And I think what's actually going on, the deeper undercurrent, is that I think Mr. Erdogan knows full well it's off the table for generations, the EU accession, that the visa deal is probably going to break down, and he is not breaking with the West, but this is a moment where Turkey sort of understands in itself, where Turkey, we're going to look in that direction, we are not going to be part of this great European project, and they're even tinkering and tweaking the Americans' tail when it comes to NATO.
The insights of Tim Marshall. John Everard here as well on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up next, London's police breaking out the big guns. But does anyone feel safer?
For all of Paris's vibrancy, its story is best evoked in the places where time just marched on past. To find them, you'll have to take the rue less travelled, just like the artists and thinkers who made the city famous. This is where the Monocle Travel Guide to Paris steps in. We've cut through all the touristy noise to uncover the lesser-known gems that we feel embody the essence of the French capital. To watch our film celebrating the 10th edition of the Monocle Travel Guide series, head to monocle.com et voilà.
Twenty-three minutes past the hour exactly. The fact that very few British police carry guns is a perhaps slightly quaint hangover from a rather more civilised era, but terror attacks across Europe this summer and last year have increased pressure on London's police to show they're ready to respond to a similar attack in the UK. Today, the Metropolitan Police unveiled 600 new masked officers who'll be equipped with Kevlar body armour, sniper rifles, handguns, automatic assault rifles, submachine guns and tasers. It's meant to reassure the city. But would you feel remotely reassured if you saw one on your street? Tim Marshall, would that assuage any fears you had about terror or other crime for that matter?
No, because the chances of you being next to the person or them being within, 60 seconds of you if in something happening is slim. However, let me take issue with your introduction, if you forgive me. They didn't unveil 600. They announced that there will be, in the future, at some point, 600. It is not to say there's going to be 600 robocops roaming around London all the time. There isn't. There aren't even. If you've got 600 people, I'd put that with sick leave, holidays, time off, having to sleep. There'll be a few dozen every day at the most. And most of them will not be walking around like RoboCop with submachine guns. They will be strategically dotted around in certain areas, inside police stations. Some of them will have the kit in the cars. And I am afraid I support this. I think it's 2016. I wish it wasn't necessary. I think it is. But as I said, I don't see this as a massive fundamental shift because the numbers involved will be so small. The one thing that struck me was, not literally, the motorbike. I was over in Jerusalem a few months ago, and what they have learned is they can't get through the traffic, and so they put two officers on motorbikes and they dot them around the city centre. And within 60 seconds for them, because they've got slightly different traffic to London, within 60 seconds of a shooting, they can be on the scene. I think it takes slightly longer in London.
But ballpark. So, I mean, it's interesting, John, you were sort of nodding there, but I mean, Tim's probably right, isn't he? We look at whether this is a pragmatic ploy or a PR play, and, you know, I read the introduction. I've fallen for a PR really? Play, haven't I?
Well, I think it's more than just a PR play. There's a lot of substance to this. I mean, it's important to remember that in a lot of ways, we're simply trying to get back to where we were, that the number of armed response officers has fallen by 1,000 over the last 5 years. So we're bringing another 1,500 in, so we end up with just a few more than we started with. It's not like we're about to transform British society. Yes, I love the point about the motorbikes. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. 60 seconds in Israel, that's commendable. Remember that when Lee Rigby was attacked, the response time was 11 minutes, and the two attackers, who fortunately had no plan to kill anybody apart from Lee Rigby, just stood around looking bored, waiting for the police to turn up. If they had had different plans, if they had had assault weapons, then those 11 minutes could have been a very long time indeed. Understandable they want to crush that time down as far as possible.
I just wanted to make one other point about this, which is, and that's interesting, John, from what you're saying about this 5 years reduction in numbers. You know, it's been a decade or more, touch wood, since we've had a major incident in London. So where does the credit fall for that? Is that something that's shared between all the emergency services, first responders, the Met Police, intelligence services? Or do you think it's more likely that it's the intelligence services nipping things in the bud?
The intelligence services.
I mean, there have been dozens of plots that they've nipped in the bud.
That's right. I mean, anybody in security service will tell you that we've had a few near misses and some quite scary ones. As they say, it's the nature of their work. They can't talk about their successes. But they have been very, very busy, and they have stopped a very lot of naughty things.
And very briefly on the numbers going down, it is actually to their credit that people join the British police force not wanting to shoot guns, and that's actually why they're struggling to get people. They cannot get enough volunteers of the right caliber, and that's why the numbers have actually dropped, because coppers say, you know, I don't want to carry a gun. There's also the thing, at the moment you fire it, you're suspended and there's an investigation, but no, they don't want to, but I think in limited way we need it.
One other point. You talked about the publicity on all this to start with. The police are very keen to stress that they want these people to be approachable and to chatter to members of the public. Fine, well, go with that. If that is so, why in all their publicity photographs of this great launch are all the officers wearing balaclavas right across their faces?
It doesn't look like
Because they've got families.
We'll give them the benefit of that on the anonymity index.
I didn't see a single woman there.
Good point, John. Just before the end of the show, let's head to South Korea. The nation's cracking down not on terror, but on graft. New laws prevent the abuse of freebies being gifted to civil servants and such like. They include luxurious meals, plenty of rounds of golf, and expensive gifts like ginseng and the region's prized Hanwoo beef. John, would you ever tempted to accept some delicious Hanwoo for the favour here and there on the Korean peninsula?
I've had Hanwoo a couple of times. I hesitate, sort of handed to me, sort of, you know, through a backhander. It's very nice beef. I'm not a great beef eater myself, but, you know, if you're into that, then fine. Hanwoo's pretty near top of the range. As part of the gift, as they say, which are a traditional part of Korean culture. One interesting point about all this is that alongside Hanwoo beef, Spam is still a firm favourite, because in the bad old days of the early American bases, only rich people with American contacts could get Spam. Wow. And it still has a kind of prestige. Curious.
And just that briefly, I mean, how much of a problem is this? Is it something that's, you know, it's noticeable how difficult it was to do business, or it was causing real ructions in the civil service community? It seems to be a relatively easy place to do business, isn't it, in South Korea?
It is fairly easy to do business, but people were clearly concerned that business decisions were being swayed by, not by the factors involved, but by the availability of Hanwoo beef, which is probably not a good way to make a business decision.
Tim, if you can forgive a pun, has anyone ever tried to curry favour with you with a gift of handwork?
I have had to return a couple of times things like watches from unnamed embassies. Very briefly on South Korea, this relates to civil servants, teachers and journalists, but does not apply to members of parliament.
Yes.
Well, I mean, and that's quite curious because of these sort of anti-corruption issues, it's mainly been focused on, I think, is it a former Prime Minister, John, who's run into problems?
But he didn't receive any nice hamwoo beef. He was caught with a shopping bag with 30 million won. Now, and because this 2013, at the time, the highest nomination banknote was 10,000 won. So he had 3,000 banknotes in the shopping bag. Must have been pretty heavy.
Very briefly, it's not that bad. South Korea, I looked it up in Transparency International, is 37th out of 168 countries. And clearly trying to go higher in that
list. A little better. But that's not too bad, is it?
No.
Top 40.
Not too shabby.
Used to mean something back in the day. Gentlemen, thank you very much, as always, for being with us. That's Tim Marshall and John Everard, my guests today on Midori House. Thanks to our show's producer, Tom Hall, our research team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sai Villafuerte, and our studio manager, George McDonough. More music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Do join us then. From me, Tom Edwards, and the rest of the team, thanks for tuning in. Goodbye.